In the new book, Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney and the White House, Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent for the New York Times, takes us on a gripping and intimate journey through the 8 years of the Bush and Cheney administration in a narrative of dramatic and a very controversial presidency. Again, the title of the book is Days of Fire, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Peter Baker to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Give us a sense of what you wanted to examine in looking at this partnership, which you really describe from the very beginning as a very complex partnership.
Well, it is. Look, you know, I think we have oversimplified this, the retelling of it over the years, Cheney the puppet master, Bush, the puppet. And in fact, any serious look at what that relationship was really like shows a more complex, three-dimensional picture. Cheney was undoubtedly influential, probably the most influential vice president we've ever seen in the early years of the Bush presidency. But I think that underestimates how much he was pushing on open doors with a president who wanted to go in the direction that Cheney was leading. And then things began to change. It was a relationship that then evolved over time to the point where Bush began drifting away toward other priorities, more diplomacy, more compromises in some of the security policies to win over broader support in public, while Cheney remained fixed on the goals that he had set from the beginning.
Why did George W. Bush want him in the first place?
Well, I think Bush, as a governor of Texas, understood that he didn't have great seasoning when it came to national security and was looking for a way of reassuring the country that if they elected him, he would have that sort of experience at his fingertips. Cheney is only actually 5 years older than Bush, but he comes across is an older, more experienced figure. And in fact, while we think of him one way today, in 2000, he was seen as a reassuring figure to a lot of voters.
When it came to that experience and the seasoning, if you will, was there a relationship that began when George W. Bush's father was in the White House?
Well, there was some of that. In fact, neither one remembers exactly when they first met, but in doing a lot of research, I came up with a meeting when they apparently first got together in 1987, as Bush's father was running for president, and the younger Bush was soliciting support on Capitol Hill, and he was brought to the, you know, one day to the office of a young congressman from Wyoming named Dick Cheney, and obviously they must have hit it off, because even a few years later, when his father was running for re-election, the younger Bush, W. Bush, urged him to dump Dan Quayle from the ticket and put Dick Cheney on it.
In choosing a title of this book of Days of Fire, why does that tell the story, do you think?
Well, the Day of Fire is a phrase used by Bush in his second inaugural address. He's using it to refer to 9/11. But I think as you look back at the full 8 years, you see there were just multiple days of fire, 8 years of them, a crisis after another. Any presidency would have been hobbled by any one of these, but he had war, terrorism, natural disaster, financial collapse. By the end of his presidency, he was giving an award to Morgan Freeman, the actor, and he gets up and he recalls all the different roles that Morgan Freeman has played. Well, one of them was he played president in his movie Deep Impact when a comet hits the planet. And then he kind of turns to his side and says, that's about the only thing that hasn't happened in the last 8 years.
When you talk about the early days when the president leaned on Dick Cheney in a far more regular way than he did later in the administration, what was he looking for?
Later in the administration, he was looking for ways of changing the direction of his presidency. I think that by the time that the Iraq War had gone south, he was looking for a way to kind of put a new energy into his administration. He expresses this idea of a democracy agenda in a more forceful way. He turns to Condoleezza Rice to try to negotiate with North Korea and Iran and Middle East peace. And he starts to shave some of the edges off the more controversial policies of his first term, because he understands that if they're going to survive his presidency, he has to have something that can be supported by Democrats as well as Republicans. And those were, in Cheney's view, those were mistakes. He didn't think that they should be compromising quite so much. He thought that some of the changes and the diplomacy was not in the best interest of the country.
You make this point in the book, but I'm curious as to your thoughts on how they trusted each other.
Yes, Yes, I think they did. I think that there was, in fact, a lot of trust, especially in the early days. I think that Cheney subordinated himself to Bush in a way that almost no vice president has done in modern times. He came in without his own aspiration to be president, which is pretty unusual. And he, in effect, quite deferential to Bush in these meetings, while everybody sort of imagines him being the uber force in any kind of debate. In fact, he would usually sit back and not say anything unless Bush asked him for his opinion. But the trick was he would then stay behind after everybody else left, and he would get the one-on-one time with the president so that people didn't quite know what he was advising, but that he had the last shot at influencing the decision.
You spoke about Iraq a moment ago and the impact that it had on the relationship. In the path to war, it did seem, while there were some on the outside, while there were some in the administration who didn't think that it was the best thing to do and the best course of action, that you paint a picture that certainly it seemed inevitable.
There was sort of like a runaway train, kind of quality to it. Once they sort of started heading down this path, it kind of took on a life of its own, and there was a momentum that was really hard to stop. In fact, Karen Hughes, who was the president's former counselor and very trusted aide, he really relied on her a lot. She had gone back to Texas and kind of looked up one day to see Vice President Cheney giving a pretty tough speech about Saddam Hussein, and recognized that they seemed to be heading toward a confrontation. And she was very skeptical about it, called the president and said, "Why are we doing this?" And he said, "Well, go have dinner with Condi Rice, and she'll fill you in." But even then, she sort of kept trying to find ways of giving him an out, to give him an exit ramp, so he didn't feel like he was railroaded into war just because he had made a number of statements up until then, that he would always have an alternative if he decided he wanted it.
And when it came to the intelligence regarding weapons of mass destruction and the controversy over that intelligence and the false nature of it, this drove deep divisions within the administration.
Well, of course it did. Colin Powell emerged from that experience feeling quite scarred. He, of course, was the front man at the United Nations,
right,
presenting the intelligence. He was so worried about it himself that he went and spent several days at the CIA personally going through it. But in the end, obviously, turned out he presented information that was not correct, and I think even to this day feels quite burned about that, quite upset that his credibility, in effect, was put out there and on the line. So this is, it was a difficult time for a lot of people who were in that administration, scarring time for some of them.
George Tenet believed he was also being made into a fall guy.
Yeah, absolutely. After the controversy over the 16 words, those were the words that President Bush said in his inaugural address in 2003 that turned out to rely on false intelligence. Tenet felt like he was being laid out to blame, and even though the CIA at one point had warned the White House not to rely on that particular allegation. So that was quite a fall from grace, if you will, because Bush really did like Tenet in the early days and relied on him. So there were a number of these sort of broken relationships that emerged from this administration.
One of those broken relationships, and back to Colin Powell, was between Cheney and Colin Powell.
Right. They had been partners, of course, during the Gulf War under Bush's father. You remember, of course, watching those press conferences with the two of them side by side, and they were very lockstep together, it seemed like, at that time. But in this administration, it was different. Powell's theory was that Cheney had always been much more conservative than certainly he was, Powell was, but that the difference was that in the Ford administration and the first Bush administration, he was in effect offset by more moderate figures who kept him in check, if you will, including President Ford and President Bush 41. But by Bush 43, he didn't have that sort of constraints on him, and his natural beliefs were given fuller opportunities to express themselves.
You write in the book, and I think it's very telling about the relationship when it came to the decision as to the political future of Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary. The president struggled very much when it came to finding a new defense secretary and whether this man should be fired.
Yeah, no, of course. People around the president were telling him as early as 2004 that he should replace Secretary Rumsfeld. They thought that the war was going badly and that they needed fresh leadership in there. And the president resisted, partly because Cheney resisted, but also because I think he felt that was somehow maybe disloyal to somebody who, in his view, hadn't done anything wrong. But by the time 2006 comes around, obviously the war has been going so badly for so long. They're heading toward the midterms, which are going to be a disaster for the Republicans. And Bush does decide to replace Cheney and doesn't tell Cheney, replace Rumsfeld and doesn't tell Cheney about it. And when I asked Cheney about it during one of our interviews, he said by the time he mentioned it to me, it wasn't open for discussion anymore.
When you think of that and then the end portrait that we see of ultimately at the end of the administration of these two men, Cheney and Bush, so far apart, and really fighting as the inauguration of President Barack Obama is getting ready to get started, it really shows how fractured the relationship had become.
It did, yes. It was a dramatic finish to their administration, but it was the culmination of several years of growing distance and frustration. President Cheney was very frustrated by policies on all sorts of things that he had been on the other side of, whether it be Iran, North Korea, Syria, Lebanon, Russia, climate change, gun rights, gay rights, auto bailout, all sorts of debates that he had lost. So he comes to the president last few weeks of the administration and, in effect, asks for one last thing, a pardon for his former chief of staff, Scooter Libby, who had been convicted in the CIA leak case. And the president wouldn't give it to him. It was, they had a very tense confrontation about it, where the vice president says, "I can't believe you're leaving a wounded man, a good man wounded on the field of battle."
And I mean, you talk about this last weekend that he spent at Camp David, and he was consumed with this.
He was, yes. Even after he had really sort of made up his mind, he couldn't quite finalize it. And he's at Camp David with family and friends. Condi Rice is there. A number of other top aides that he was really close with were there. The vice president was not there. And he kept thinking about it. In fact, he called his old aide, Dan Bartlett, back in Texas and said, "This just sucks. I can't stop thinking about it." Condi Rice pulls him off into another room and says, "Don't let this be a pall over your last few days." You could see how much it was weighing on him. And finally, even Laura Bush says to him, "Just make up your mind. You're ruining this for everybody." So, it was an unusual thing and tells you how much it weighed on him, because he did style himself as the decider, as somebody who made a decision and then moved on without dwelling on it. In this case, he was dwelling on it.
What do you think the relationship is like now?
I think it's proper, and I think it's appropriate and polite. I don't think it's close. They've each moved on. President Bush went back to Texas, and as he told guests there one time, he said when he saw Obama raise his hand over the Bible and the inaugural address, the inauguration in 2009, Bush thought to himself, "Free at last, free at last." And Cheney headed to his home in Maryland and Wyoming, and he also felt free, but he felt free to start speaking out in public in a way he hadn't. He became a tough and very sharp critic of President Obama, some of his policies. And in some ways, I think the argument he was making against Obama was sort of a proxy for the argument he had made in private with President Bush in those last few years, but now he was free to do so and criticize a Democrat rather than the president who would put him on the ticket in the first place.
It's a fascinating examination. It is Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House. It's published by Doubleday. Peter Baker, thank you very much for spending time with us. I so appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.